KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. 3 years into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we ask Latvia's former prime minister what he thinks about President Trump's change in policy toward the war. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, an investigation into dating apps finds they're slow to remove people reported for abuse. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. So what is the company behind Hinge and Tinder doing to keep users safe? Also, Sarah Silverman on turning the childhood shame of wetting the bed into a musical and whether tariffs actually help save America's tin plate industry. It is Friday, February 21st. On this day in 1965, human rights activist Malcolm X was shot to death at a Harlem speaking event. Three men were convicted in the killing, but two were later exonerated. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli authorities say a body returned yesterday by Hamas is not the hostage who the militants say that it was. Four bodies were handed over yesterday. One of them was supposed to be that of hostage Shiri Bibas, but it wasn't. Israel says the body does not belong to any known hostage. The handover is part of the ceasefire deal. Six living hostages are also supposed to be handed over tomorrow, and scores of Palestinians are supposed to be released from Israeli prisons. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi says currently that is still scheduled to happen.
NPR talked to an Israeli official who's familiar with the matter, but they weren't authorized to speak publicly. And we were told that Israel is actually inclined to move ahead with Saturday's prisoner exchange. They said Israel just doesn't want to jeopardize the release of the Israeli hostages this weekend. But then the official also said Israel is going to take advantage that Shiri Bibas's body wasn't returned as a point of negotiation to ask for more hostage releases.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reporting. Many of the 178 Venezuelan migrants recently sent to Guantanamo Bay have now been repatriated, NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
A spokeswoman for DHS said 177 migrants have been sent back to Venezuela and one brought back to an immigration facility in the U.S. The move to hold migrants at Guantanamo was controversial. In recent days, immigrants' rights lawyers went to court to seek access to the detainees. The Trump administration alleged that many were members of the international criminal organization Tren de Aragua, which has been recently designated as a foreign terrorist organization. But in an official statement from the colonel running the operation, it is now revealed that 51 of the detainees were considered low threats. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
A federal judge has ruled against labor unions that sued to try to stop the Trump administration's layoffs of federal employees. NPR's Ryland Barton reports.
The union sued to stop three Trump initiatives: firing federal employees on probationary status, plans for large-scale reductions in the federal workforce, and the deferred resignation program. U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper said he didn't have jurisdiction over the claims and that unions would have to bring their claims before an independent agency that governs labor issues in the federal workforce. The judge did note that the first month of the administration has been defined by executive actions that have caused, quote, disruption and even chaos in widespread quarters of American society. Several other lawsuits over Trump's actions continue. Federal courts have had mixed decisions so far. Ryland Barton, NPR News.
The man accused of killing United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson last year in New York will appear in a state courtroom today. Luigi Mangione is facing several murder counts and another of an act of terrorism. He's pleaded not guilty. Today's hearing is for lawyers to provide a status update on the case. This is NPR. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she will not remove embattled New York City Mayor Eric Adams from office. She says she will work to create guardrails around him. Adams has been accused of corruption, charges he denies. The Trump administration has moved to drop the case against him. Several federal prosecutors have quit, alleging the administration is doing this in exchange for Adams' help on immigration. That's been denied by the administration. Scientists say that for centuries, people have collected water from fog, but this practice has only recently been closely examined. NPR's Regina Barber reports on a study that attempts to harness fog to supply water for a lot more people.
Alto Especial lies in the Atacama Desert, and it's perfectly situated to collect fog. At about 2,000 feet in Chile,
Alto Especial is the only city which is inside of the cloud.
That's geographer Virginia Carter. She led a study that gathered data at various fog collection sites around the city for a year. In the past, fog collection has only been studied and used in small villages. But for the first time, Carter and her team used computer modeling to map how much water could be collected from fog all over the region. They found that fog could supply hundreds of thousands of liters of drinking water per week, enough to supplement the water demands of under-resourced parts of the city. Regina Barber, NPR News.
The National Weather Service says an Arctic air mass will persist over the central and southern U.S. today. It got cold in Florida. Wind chills in parts of northern Florida fell to about 17 degrees earlier this morning. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will hear from the former Prime Minister of Latvia to get his take on what the Trump administration's increasingly pro-Russia tilt means for the region.
First, how much does it matter that the United States has changed how it talks about Ukraine? For some analysts, the president's statements and actions this week signal a fundamental shift in the way the United States approaches the whole world. We heard one of those analysts this week on the program, Richard Haass, who saw the possible end of the world order the U.S. has dominated since the end of the Second World War. Well, let's get the details of how things are going day by day from NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so what has President Trump changed in U.S. policy as he seeks a ceasefire in Ukraine?
Well, he's absolutely shocked the Ukrainians as well as many Europeans by taking almost everything the Biden administration was doing and turning it upside down. And it's quite simply, in a number of ways, he now seems more aligned with Russia than with Ukraine. He has called Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, a dictator. He's blaming Ukraine for the full-scale Russian invasion that marks its third anniversary Monday. The president is pressing Zelensky to sign a deal that would give the U.S. half of Ukraine's most valuable minerals. So Ukraine is in a tough spot, but it's not yet clear whether Trump's approach will work.
And, of course, the administration is talking to Zelensky. Trump's special envoy, Keith Kellogg, met Zelensky yesterday in Kyiv. I was just looking at the television, seeing pictures of them shaking hands and so forth. How'd the meeting go?
Yeah, so in his nightly address, Zelensky said the meeting with Kellogg, quote, restores hope. So perhaps the tone in the private discussion was a little less harsh than what we're hearing publicly. Zelensky stressed the need for security guarantees to make sure Russia can never attack again. So again, talks seemed cordial, but not clear if they resolved any key issues.
People we've heard in the program, including people close to the president over the last couple of months, have suggested that Trump is going to put pressure on both sides for a peace deal. That would imply real pressure, added pressure on Russia. Is the president putting extra pressure on Russia?
Well, we're not seeing that. This flurry of activity began last week when Trump called Russian leader Vladimir Putin, signaling that the U.S. was no longer trying to isolate Putin. We aren't hearing real criticism of the Russian leader, and Trump's language in attacking Ukraine has echoes of the way Russia describes Ukraine. And Russian leaders seem thrilled. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev wrote on social media, quote, "If you'd told me just 3 months ago that these were the words of the U.S. president, I would have laughed out loud."
Is Russia doing more to encourage Trump?
Well, the Russians are talking about how normal relations could have economic benefits and ease international tensions for both sides. Here's Andrew Weiss at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington.
The Russians have been very good at dangling opportunities in front of the Trump administration. The price, of course, would be for the United States to curtail the support we've been providing to Ukraine. You know, the Russians have a great expression: the only free cheese is in a mousetrap.
Okay, so let's get back to this big question of the world order. What does all this mean for the U.S. role in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, if you take Trump at his word, he's breaking with this fundamental principle of mutual defense between the U.S. and Europe that was enshrined with the formation of NATO after World War II. The president is signaling to Europe that their security is their business and they're way too dependent on the U.S. So perhaps what we're seeing in Ukraine doesn't just seem to be about Ukraine. It appears to reflect how Trump says he wants to deal with all of Europe.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Steve.
We wanted to get a view from Europe, so let's go to Latvia now. It's a small country between the Baltic Sea and Russia, formerly part of the Soviet Union. We have Latvia's former Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, Kristianis Kariņš, on the line now from Riga. Good morning, Minister. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. My pleasure to be with you.
You know, our colleague Greg Myrie just summed up comments by President Trump and other positions taken by the U.S. that look like a tilt toward Russia and away from Ukraine in the past week. What do you make of it?
Well, this is actually a very serious concern for peace in the world, certainly for Europe, and certainly for a country like Latvia. We are a NATO member. We're a member of the European Union. We invest in our defense. We're at 3.5% of GDP right now. Next year, the government's going to go up to 4%. I think it'll go even further, up to 5% eventually in a couple of years. We have participated when the U.S. asked in action, military action in Afghanistan and Iraq. Our soldiers have fought and died alongside American soldiers. And now we're listening to the U.S. president sort of casting doubt on this entire structure. And the difficulty is, of course, is that Europe as a continent is nowhere near ready to replace the U.S., say, overnight in terms of securing NATO's defenses in Europe. I agree with President Trump that Europe needs to pull its weight. Europe needs to invest in its defense. I fully agree with this. This is a message that really goes back 14 years to President Obama. In the east of Europe, in Latvia, in the Baltic countries, in Poland, we heeded this message. We have invested in our defense. We are up to snuff, shall we say, in terms of what we need to do. But the rest of Europe, the larger parts of Europe, the big countries like Germany, France, the UK, Italy, Spain, these countries are unfortunately not there, and we need them to follow our example so that the U.S. could pivot more to Asia, to the Pacific. That makes sense. Europe can and should do it.
Do you think that this is a tactic, a negotiating tactic, to get Europe to boost its defense spending, or do you think there's something else behind it?
I would be the happiest person in the world if this were a tactic. And certainly, whatever Trump's ultimate goal is, he is having the effect that is needed, that is rattling, shall we say, some of the more complacent European leaders into action. This is very, very good news. What is unclear to me is, if this is a tactic, what is the purpose of actually saying complete falsehoods, saying that democratically elected Zelensky is a dictator, but not saying that non-democratically elected Putin is not? So the tactic sort of makes sense on one part, but it doesn't make sense. Why is the U.S. president saying the things that he's saying?
What do you see is at stake for countries like Latvia if there is more behind this than a negotiating tactic? What do you see is at stake for a country like yours and others that are similarly situated?
Very simply, our freedom and our independence. We are a country of under 2 million people. That's a small country. Next to us is an aggressive Russia. 110, 120 million people. The only way we can stand up against them, and they have occupied our country, they have tortured, they have deported, they have molested our citizens. We've experienced everything that Ukraine is experiencing now. We've done that in our past multiple times. We exist because of the world order that says the rule of law is what guides everything, not the rule of force. So we cannot exist without multilateralism, without democracies banding together to stand up against the countries that are threatening all of us. There's an axis, you can see it. It's Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. Europe is interested in standing up against this. The US is interested in standing up against this. We both need to stand together. And yes, I agree, Europe needs to invest in its defense and be able to take over the role in Europe from the US within the NATO framework, all the time working with the US.
That is Kristijanis Kariņš. He is the former prime minister and the foreign minister of Latvia. He's now a global security consultant. Minister, thanks so much for talking with us and sharing these insights. I do hope we'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, this is kind of a cool fellowship, a little bit different. Sometimes you get a fellowship when you're a student and relatively young. Sometimes people get fellowships so they can go off and study mid-career. This is a fellowship for jazz musicians who are at least 62 years old, and 20 of them get $100,000 each. NPR's Phil Harrell reports.
The Andrew W. Mellon Foundation came up with the idea of honoring elder jazz musicians. Elizabeth Alexander is Mellon's president.
Many of the folks who have been making the music forever were in need of support. What would it mean to really say, we recognize your brilliance and we want at this point in your lives to be able to be as helpful as possible?
The life of a working jazz musician is a precarious one.
That is Joe Petroselli. He's the executive director of the Jazz Foundation of America, which is administering the fellowships. The group regularly gives support to struggling musicians.
They don't have adequate insurance. They really live gig to gig. And when you encounter a crisis, there's very little to fall back on.
That's why the panel made a point of emphasizing mostly unheralded artists.
Who are the artists who are so deserving of an honor like this, but have never received anything like it?
They're as young as 62-year-old drummer Shannon Powell and as old as 94-year-old trumpeter Dizzy Reese. Petroselli hears that a lot of the recipients want to use the money to continue their work.
Artists who have composed operas that are unfinished, that will now have an opportunity to complete them. Musicians who have archives of unreleased recordings that they've never really been able to get around to evaluating and releasing.
68-year-old drummer Herlin Riley says he intends to give away his $100,000.
I try to be a giving and sharing person, so I'm happy that I can help make a difference in some other people's lives.
Riley spent his career keeping the beat for greats like Wynton Marsalis. Also George Benson, Ahmad Jamal, Marcus Roberts. It's an impressive list. Riley says the fellowship came as a complete surprise, especially at this stage of his career.
Oftentimes it happens where you get your accolades after you pass away. It's so nice to get your flowers while you can still smell them.
The plan is to award 30 more fellowships over the next 3 years, at least. Phil Harrell, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
the next Fresh Air, actor Andrew Scott. He first became known in the U.S. as the Hot Priest because of his role in Fleabag. Now he's nominated for a SAG Award for his starring role in the Netflix series Ripley, adapted from the novel The Talented Mr. Ripley. He won a National Society of Film Critics Award for his performance in All of Us Strangers. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Comedian Sarah Silverman says she takes inspiration from a quote by the Catholic priest and author Father Gregory Boyle.
And it's basically, if you don't make friends with your wounds, you will be tempted to despise the wounded.
Silverman grew up with an emotional wound, the shame of being a bedwetter. She wrote a best-selling memoir about this, which is now a musical, currently at Washington, D.C.'s Arena Stage. NPR's Elizabeth Blair talked with Silverman.
The Bedwetter is a poignant musical comedy about healing. It takes place when Sarah Silverman is 10 years old. She becomes depressed when she's ostracized because of her bedwetting. Her father goes overboard trying to help her, taking her to a hypnotist and a doctor who overprescribes Xanax. Sarah's mother pleads with Sarah's father to stop trying to fix her.
You can't fix her. She's not broken. She's just having trouble coping. The ground underneath her has shifted a bit. The clouds overhead haven't lifted just yet.
He learns, you know, to stop trying to fix it and to just listen. And when he does that, he's able to relate to her on some level.
And when her father listens, Sarah opens up and shares with him how she misses being nine.
When I was nine, you and Mom had all the answers. When I was nine, we were one weird, cool family.
Silverman has explored the need to listen to each other before in her series from some years ago called I Love You, America.
The biggest thing I learned was that facts don't, shockingly, and this is true for all of us, facts really don't change people's minds. Feelings do. And that's, you know, obviously why art is so important.
Because art is all about feelings. Sarah Silverman hopes The Bedwetter makes it to Broadway. It's at Arena Stage until March 16th. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
Now, if you're at a point in your life where you're looking for a romantic partner, then you almost certainly know about or have considered the apps. A Pew Research poll from 2023 found that 1 in 10 American adults in a relationship met their partner on a dating app. But how safe are those apps? A team of journalists undertook an 18-month investigation into The Match Group, which owns Tinder, Hinge, and other online dating apps used by millions of people every month. They found that the company is slow to ban users after they are accused of assault and other bad behavior. I spoke with reporter Emily Elena Dugdale. She worked on that investigation, which was produced with the Pulitzer Center's AI Accountability Network. In your reporting, you start with a very disturbing case. You point to a case involving a cardiologist in Denver who was just sentenced to a lengthy prison term after a jury convicted him for sexually assaulting and drugging multiple women. How is Match Group involved in that case?
Yeah, so Stephen Matthews used Match Group apps Tinder and Hinge to match with and then sexually assault and drug women. He was reported in the app as far back as 2020, but was able to continue using them and assault women for years. He was only stopped when a survivor went to the police. In fact, after he was reported, he was even featured as a standout date on Hinge, which means the app actually promoted his profile to women looking for matches.
You wrote that Match Group actually dismantled safety efforts that they rolled out 5 years ago after pressure from Wall Street investors. What happened?
Yeah, so on the heels of some bad press, Match Group created a new safety team in 2020 and promised to release what's known in tech circles as a transparency report, which would tell the public about the number of people reported for rape and other bad activity on their platforms so that users can assess their risk. Basically, it would give the public an idea of what's happening under the hood in terms of harm. 5 years have passed, but that report hasn't been published.
Why not?
Good question. We got hundreds of internal company documents. They showed the company waffled over what information to keep secret. And one employee wrote that they felt pressured to rush through safety checks and cut corners. They wrote, quote, "The obsession with metrics and having to stick with them is frustrating and potentially dangerous. This is not the way we were meant to work, and people's lives are at risk."
What does Match Group have to say about all this?
So we sent Match Group a four-page statement detailing everything we found. The company responded with a short statement. Match Group said it was an industry leader on safety, using, quote, harassment preventing AI tools, ID verification for profiles, and investments in communicating with law enforcement. They said that they are committed to doing the work to make dating safer on the platforms, but that's not what we found when we tested their apps. We partnered with The Markup, who led an experiment where we created dating profiles that we reported for sexual assault and then were banned. We found that users could quickly create Tinder accounts with the exact same name, birthday, and profile photos used on their banned accounts. They can also hop over to Hinge and other apps without changing those details. And that cardiologist I was talking about earlier, he was sentenced to 158 years in prison. The reality is, if he were released today, he could get right back on a dating app.
The same company owns these apps. Why don't they ban bad actors across platforms?
One of the issues when we talked to employees was just that it takes a lot of human labor and time to be able to thoroughly investigate these cases. It takes sometimes hours. We quoted one of these employees, Michael Laurie, who said, you know, he was spending hours and hours sometimes on a case and felt a lot of pressure to speed up. And so I think, unfortunately, it's just that these are expensive hires and the company really wanted to go a more cheap route. And so a lot of that work was outsourced to folks who don't have that same level of experience.
You know, some might argue, well, millions of people use these apps and they have some bad experiences, but people who meet people in other ways have bad experiences too. Like, what would you say to that?
I think that the issue here is that Match Group knows that there are people on their apps who are on there to harm others, and they could actually share that information so that users could really assess their risk and decide whether or not they want to use that platform.
That is Emily Elena Dugdale. She is an investigative reporter who looked into the safety of dating apps. You can read her reporting in The Guardian, The Markup, or The 19th. Emily, thanks so much for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration's rhetoric on expansion has been pretty unpopular among Greenlandic citizens.
We will never surrender to anyone.
But there are some outliers.
From the first term, I was supporting him here in Greenland.
I'm Juana Summers in Greenland's capital with diverging views on Trump's ambitions here. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
It appears Israel will go ahead with tomorrow's planned release of more Palestinians as part of its ceasefire agreement with Hamas. That's despite Israel saying one of four bodies released by Hamas yesterday was not an Israeli mother taken hostage by the militants in southern Israel 16 months ago. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi says the mother's two young children were confirmed to be among the other three bodies released by the militants.
Israeli forensic officials positively identified the bodies of Ariel and Kfir Bibas, who were 4 years old and 9 months old at the time of their kidnapping by Hamas on October 7, 2023. But the Israeli military said the body Hamas claims was their mother, Shiri Bibas, was in fact another body. The Israeli military said this was, quote, a violation of the utmost severity by Hamas. Six live Israeli hostages are expected to be exchanged for 600 Palestinian prisoners and detainees on Saturday. An Israeli official familiar with the matter, who could not speak publicly, told NPR that Israel is inclined to move ahead with that swap to avoid impacting the release of the Israeli hostages. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Jericho.
A judge has declined to dismiss key evidence in the trial of the man charged with killing four students at the University of Idaho. This is NPR News from Washington. The man charged with killing the CEO of United Healthcare in New York City is due in court today. Luigi Mangione will appear on state charges of murder and terrorism. The 26-year-old is facing separate federal charges for the killing of Brian Thompson outside a hotel in Midtown Manhattan back in December. Mangione could face the death penalty if convicted on the federal counts. The Vatican says Pope Francis continues to show slight improvement at a hospital in Rome. That's where he's being treated for pneumonia in both lungs. NPR's Ruth Sherlock says the 88-year-old pontiff's health is fueling speculation about whether Francis might one day retire.
Pope Francis's predecessor, the late Pope Benedict XVI, became the first pope to retire in some 600 years. His resignation highlighted the papacy as a complex and human role. The now 88-year-old Francis has confirmed that shortly after being elected pontiff, he wrote a resignation letter in case medical problems should prevent him from being able to carry out his duties. But the pope has also in the past called the idea that he might resign only a, quote, distant hypothesis. He's known for keeping a non-stop schedule. Even from hospital, the Vatican says, he's continued to fulfill some of his work duties. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 233 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Anytime now, a judge decides whether to let the Justice Department drop a corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. The Trump administration asked for that against a lot of blowback. Multiple officials resigned rather than drop a case for explicitly political reasons. Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bove ordered prosecutors to drop the case in part so the administration could use Adams for immigration enforcement. This week, a different Justice Department official apparently tried a do-over, offering his own rationale to drop the case. And this caught the eye of Jason Willick, a columnist for The Washington Post.
Now you're referring to Chad Mizzell, who's the chief of staff to the attorney general. And he emphasized instead that this is a weak case, that the Supreme Court has been skeptical of certain theories of corruption charges, and the case was just too vulnerable on appeal, basically, to go forward, and that was the number one reason. Now, Emil Bove, in his letter to the Southern District of New York asking for the case's dismissal, sort of referenced that at the very end, but it was not the primary theory he led with. He sort of led with these more political justifications, and now you're seeing from a different official foregrounding the argument that should have been foregrounded all along.
Chad Mizzell, this Justice Department official, then names case after case after case, some of them famous, in which officials were convicted of corruption and the Supreme Court or other courts ultimately did overturn the conviction. What do you make of that list?
The McDonnell case is a famous one, the corruption conviction of the governor of Virginia that was reversed, but also some recent cases. The Supreme Court doesn't like the idea that you're basically going to say, we think this politician did something unethical, was clearly unseemly, and we're going to use the federal criminal laws to prosecute him for that. That was a real concern in the Eric Adams case.
At the same time, I can think of other cases that weren't mentioned in this thread. Robert Menendez, the former Democratic senator who was involved in a bribery case that involved gold bars and so forth. Some of these cases seem rather open and shut.
Yes, most politicians convicted of corruption don't have their convictions overturned, but sometimes they do. And if you read the Eric Adams indictment, there's no gold bars like Bob Menendez. We're talking about flight upgrades. This indictment is not the strongest, most clear bribery case ever. It certainly reflects behavior that seems unethical, but I would put this more close to the McDonnell category than the Menendez category.
The official message of the administration is we're going to stop prosecuting so many politicians or weaponizing the Justice Department, to use the buzz phrase that is used. When you look at the variety of statements and actions that have come out of the Justice Department so far, do you see much evidence that that is in fact the goal?
It's hard to say whether they mean we're going to stop prosecuting politicians that we favor for some reason, or we're going to actually raise the bar for prosecuting public officials on sort of these white-collar statutes.
Some people listening will wonder if this is the moment to draw back from that, given the enormous amounts of money involved and the very, very rich people who are suddenly running the government.
Well, I would frankly say one reason that Trump is in office and doing the things that he's doing with the Justice Department is that he was prosecuted by the Justice Department. I think the case against him in Florida was much stronger than the January 6th case against him. But I think what we're seeing right now is sort of a cautionary tale, because you prosecute the guy, then you end up getting an adverse Supreme Court ruling, in this case, the immunity ruling. Then you have the guy in office furious at the Justice Department and trying to turn the whole place upside down. We're seeing right now some of the downsides of mixing politics and law to this extent.
Jason Willick of The Washington Post, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
President Trump speaks fondly of a predecessor, William McKinley. McKinley is credited with imposing tariffs to save the American tin plate industry in the late 19th century. But were those tariffs successful? Our colleagues from The Indicator, Darian Woods and Waylon Wong, have one economist's take.
There are lots of motivations that drive governments to consider tariffs. One rationale is called the infant industry argument.
Doug Irwin is an economist at Dartmouth College.
If you gave it some temporary protection, eventually it would learn how to produce better, produce more efficiently, its cost would go down, and lo and behold, it would become internationally competitive.
And there's a historical example of infant industry protectionism that Doug has studied in depth, the American tinplate industry in the late 1800s.
This metal is used for products like canned food, and the history of the tinplate industry in the U.S. is pretty quirky. So in the 1860s, a new law slapped tariffs on a bunch of imported goods. Foreign-made tinplate was supposed to be included in that group. Here's what the law originally said.
On tinplate, an iron galvanized or coated with any metal, 2 cents and a half per pound. So that was the tariff, 2.5 cents per pound on tinplate.
But Doug says the Treasury Secretary at the time decided this didn't make sense the way it was written, and he decided to move a crucial comma.
He said it shouldn't be on tinplate, comma, and iron galvanized. He said it should be on tinplate and iron, comma, galvanized. And this changes the meaning because you would never galvanize tinplate. Tinplate's already galvanized. It's already been coated.
So just moving this comma meant that tinplate was excluded from these higher tariffs. And as a result, American tinplate wasn't sufficiently protected, and this kind of doomed U.S. tinplate makers.
But there were entrepreneurs from Ohio that wanted to change this. Ohio's a big iron and steel state, and these businessmen found a champion in William McKinley. He was the congressman representing Ohio at the time, and he successfully pushed for legislation that became the McKinley Tariff of 1890. That put a tariff of more than 70% on imported tinplate.
It allowed the domestic industry to start up and operate profitably. And lo and behold, they start taking over the market within 5 or 10 years. And within 20 years, we're actually exporting tinplate. So it would seem to be a great case where we protected this industry. They didn't really need it after 5 or 10 years. They sort of do extremely well and stand on their own 2 feet. Success.
Or was it? Doug decided to test whether it really was the McKinley tariff that allowed the tinplate industry to flourish.
I run a bunch of different scenarios, and what it turns out is that if we didn't protect the tinplate industry at all, it would have come about anyway. It would have come about 10 years later.
The same end result, just shifted by a decade.
So the question becomes, was the cost incurred by all the consumers of tinplate in that 10-year period worth the price of getting the tinplate industry 10 years before we would have otherwise gotten it? Turns out, according to my simulations, that it wasn't worth the price.
These tinplate consumers were food companies making canned goods and oil companies that used the material for oil drums. After McKinley became president in 1897, he shifted his thinking, and he gave a speech in September of 1901, shortly before his assassination, which said this.
Commercial wars are unprofitable.
Waylon Wong,
Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is NPR News.
Reflecting on the death of our family dog, Bisbee, who stayed at my side for more than a decade, why was it so hard to say goodbye? That's next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Birkenstocks, comfy shoes or pieces of art? Germany's highest civil court is pretty clear this week, just comfy. The shoe company, beloved by hipsters, hikers, and walkers, wanted more copyright protections to make fighting online knockoffs easier, but the court ruled nine. While Birkenstocks may indeed be iconic, the shoes' design are mostly about how they feel, not how they look. Birkenstocks says it sells the experience of walking as intended by nature, but not art. My feet agree. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's a big year for Jane Austen fans. This year is the 250th anniversary of her birth in 1775. Jane Austen's famous novels were influenced by her reading of Shakespeare and Milton, and also some women who were featured in a new book called Jane Austen's Bookshelf. This book comes from Rebecca Romney, who is a rare book dealer in Silver Spring, Maryland. Her bookshop sounds like a place worth visiting, so Morning Edition's books editor Adriana Gallardo did.
Hi guys. Did you find the place okay?
Yeah, it's not exactly a traditional bookshop, but it does have a cozy bookshop feel, I hope, when you come in.
Rebecca Romney likes to pause every few steps in the aisles of her bookshop, type punch matrix.
This book here.
To admire her literary treasures. Let's see where it
is. You feel that? You feel how it's like almost linen-y?
Yeah.
It's much softer. It has got a little bit of scratchiness to it, but it feels almost closer to fabric than it does to modern paper.
As a collector, it's not just about the storylines. Like a museum docent, she revels in the details of her rare books, some dating as far back as the 16th century. But a few years ago, one book took a hold of her.
Wait, is this the Evelina book?
This is the Evelina, yes. This is the book that started it all.
Okay.
That's British novelist Frances Burney's 1778 novel, Evelina. In it, Burney's muse navigates the complexities of 18th century high society with wit and a satirical flair. Romney, a scholar of novels, knew of the text, but soon she realized that there was much more to know about its author.
Her book, Cecilia, is probably where Austen got the phrase Pride and Prejudice. How did I not know that? If Austen loved her, why don't we still read her today? Would Austen really have such terrible taste? Is this a bad book? And then I read the book and I thought, no, actually, this is a great book. So now the question becomes, why don't we read this great book anymore? And that was the beginning of the book.
In Jane Austen's Bookshelf, Romney's new book, she spotlights eight women writers who were contemporaries of Austen, including Charlotte Lennox and Maria Edgeworth.
Most of them I haven't even heard of. And then when I researched a little bit further, I realized scholars see it this way too, because these women were so systematically excised from our understanding of the canon and the development of the novel that they gave it a name, and that name is The Great Forgetting.
Once Romney went searching for clues to better understand who these women were, a whole new set of connections emerged.
Then you start seeing this interaction between the authors, which I think was so fun. It wasn't just everything about Austen. Soon it just becomes its own constellation of writers in the 18th century, and specifically how women are talking to each other in the 18th century as artists.
As she scans the titles that inspired her book,
what else do we have here?
Romney's keen to point out that at the end of her quest, what she wrote is as much a literary altar as it is a book.
Both the book and the collection become this eulogy for these authors, because what I'm trying to do is not only get a sense of what their accomplishments were as writers, but also to give them their due. Give them the due that has been taken from them over the hundreds of years in which their reputations have slowly trickled away.
Adriana Gallardo, NPR News.
On Monday's Morning Edition, we have the story of a teenager named Gabriel who has a day-to-day challenge. He's 6'4". He is black. He's only 14, and he struggles with making sure he doesn't scare people. Join us on your phone or your smart speaker. Just say your local NPR station by name. This is NPR News.
Thank you. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The hockey rivalry between the U.S. and Canada turned ugly this week as President Trump's talk of tariffs and annexation brought geopolitics to the ice. Last night, the U.S. faced Canada in the final of the Four Nations Hockey Tournament. Canada won in overtime. Rob Lane from member station WBUR was there in Boston.
The Americans say it all started with this. Canadian fans booed the U.S. national anthem when the two teams met earlier in the tournament last Saturday.
Right off the bat, I was fired up to come because of that.
That's American fan Toby Brill. He flew in from Las Vegas to Boston and says he paid a couple grand for a ticket to the sold-out final. Grace Chipman is a Canadian fan. She lives in the U.S. but grew up in Calgary. She said Canadians had good reason to boo.
I think there's a lot of Americans who don't understand how concerned and offended Canadians are and how much Canadians have pride in their country, and that we've been friends with the U.S. for so long, friendly neighbors, that it's pretty offensive to be called the 51st state.
President Trump doubled down on his talk of annexing Canada in the hours before the rematch. He took to Truth Social to taunt Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He called him Governor Trudeau. Jake Humans, an American fan from New Jersey, echoed that tone outside the TD Garden Arena.
USA taking over Canada and their sport. We're taking over their tariffs. We own them, the 51st state.
American fans filled the arena. Many were draped in flags. They led chants. And rained vengeful boos on a rendition of O Canada in which singer Chantel Kerviosek ad-libbed pro-sovereignty lyrics. In the end, though, it was the Canadians who took the night. They won in overtime, 3-2, on a goal off the stick of star Connor McDavid. And Prime Minister Trudeau fired off a social media post of his own. "You can't take our country," he wrote on X, "and you can't take our game." For NPR News, I'm Rob Lane in Boston.
The old country song says, "Take this job and shove it." And in recent days, a number of people said so. Multiple federal prosecutors resigned rather than follow an order to drop a criminal case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Multiple deputy mayors quit in protest, too. So, we asked NPR listeners to tell us when they have quit a job that conflicted with their values.
I was only hired to make the organization look like they cared about diversity. My talent, expertise, and my voice weren't valued or respected, just the presence and the appearance of my black face.
I had submitted a competitive state grant for my program, and once awarded, I learned leadership intended to divert grant funds from the project by padding my salary in our budget. I reported this to our grant liaison and quit that day.
We just heard Emily Noyes and Latrice Sneed. Now, Rutgers philosophy professor Alex Guerrero has not quit his job, and fortunately for us, he was able to weigh in. He talked with A. Martinez.
I think for a lot of people, this comes up as a question, you know, should I be in this kind of job? Do I like this kind of job? But also, does this job serve my broader interest? Does it give me a sense of meaning and purpose? Or do I feel alienated and disconnected? Or maybe even worse, do I worry I'm really making the world worse by working in this job? So I think those issues have been ones that philosophers have thought about, both in the workplace context and sort of more generally for how to live a good ethical life.
So for people that have, say, like in the Justice Department, prosecutors that have decided to resign because they don't feel like what they're doing maybe is serving the public, I think with that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, it seems like that goes beyond what maybe they feel is something they don't want to do, as opposed to it goes against their mandate, which would be serving the public.
Yeah, I think those things can overlap in some cases. So you might well think, look, I have this job, I have this role, I have this power that's been given to me by this constitutional system, but I can only use that in certain ways. There's certain things that if I were to do them with this power, it'd be unethical and illegal. So those, I think, come together, especially when you're asked to do something that you believe to be unconstitutional, where it's really exceeding the power that is given to your role or to your office. And I think in some of those cases, you might think, it's prudentially unwise, it's bad, you know, it's illegal, maybe I'd get in trouble down the road, but you might also think it's immoral. You know, there's a limit to the kind of power that people in these roles should have over others and over the public. And there's ways of misusing that power that I think really then does become kind of deeply troubling from an ethical vantage point.
Yeah. And here's the thing too, I guess not everyone has the ability to make these kinds of decisions. I mean, are people as principled as they can afford to be?
Right. I think that is really important. There's some cases in which I think people are limited in their career options. Maybe, you know, the job is one that's keeping their family afloat. And obviously there, the calculation is different ethically too. I mean, ethics takes into account the cost to you as an individual for giving up a job, and perhaps especially if it's going to make it hard for you to get a job in the future. So I think there's real limits there, but also I think we should be wary of overly emphasizing those in some cases where I think, yeah, it might be inconvenient, might be difficult for the moment, but the more people who push back against these things, the easier it is. So there's a real collective action problem here. If too many people just go along, it makes it very hard for the few who might try to push back. Whereas if many people kind of raise their hand and say, hey, this doesn't seem right, it becomes harder to sort of fire or penalize or punish all of them.
Is there an argument that some people who choose to resign for ethical reasons ought to stay? Maybe the argument is that maybe they can do more good by staying as opposed to making a statement, a public statement, by leaving.
Absolutely. I mean, I think especially in cases where you might not be in a particularly high profile position, maybe nobody will really notice that you leave. It'll be hard to leave in a kind of noisy public way. But also there might be cases where it's really important that people stay and look for ways to fight from within, to try to push back against what's being done, to gum up the works. I think in many cases, the ethical thing to do actually is to stay in the role, as hard as it might be, because of the way in which, you know, if you leave, that you might be replaced by somebody who is gung-ho about the immoral thing and will push forward in a much worse way. But also you might well be able to help slow down the things that are being done.
That's Alex Guerrero, professor of philosophy at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. Professor, thanks.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ian Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.